Hello, and welcome back to Braincast, a student-led podcast covering a range of topics from current research to inspiring career journeys by featuring interviews with academics, researchers, and fellow students, aiming to showcase the breadth of innovation and creativity within neuroscience and psychology here at the University of Sussex and beyond. In this episode, we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Naidu, a postdoctoral researcher from the Kavli Institute at the University of Oxford. Our host, Francesca, will be speaking with Dr. Naidu about the widening participation internship she undertook at Oxford this past summer. Tune in as they discuss what it's like working in a research lab and the valuable insights gained from this experience. This is the first episode of the Early Career series, where we navigate through the multitude of different career paths that neuroscience and related fields have to offer.
Hi, this is Francesca and I'm joined here with my supervisor, Kalina Naidu. So I had an internship this summer, part of the Unique Plus program, and Kalina was my supervisor. So over to you, would you like to introduce yourself and a bit about your research currently?
Thank you, Francesca, and it's so nice to see you
it's
again.
It's so nice to see you too, it's been so long.
Yeah. So, I'm Kalina Naidu. I work at the University of Oxford. I'm a postdoctoral researcher. We're currently sat in the Kavli Institute, which is this very multidisciplinary building where we have people from physics and biochemistry and biology and medical sciences all coming together. And so my background is medical science, and I work with Richard Wade Martins and Brent Ryan, and we're interested in all things Parkinson's in our lab, and also neurodegeneration. So we've got some Alzheimer's research going on as well. And yeah, Francesca joined us for, was it 6 weeks?
It was. The internship was seven, but I was in the lab full-time six weeks.
And I think it was very much like initiation by fire, right? Like, straight off the bat. We had an ambitious project.
Yeah, but
you
I like
excellent
that.
Job, so that was good. I think the main aim with the project was for, we understood that you had like, you've never touched a pipette before, right? So we really wanted you to get as many experiences and skills from this internship you could get in 6 weeks. Yeah. And so we understood that that meant like, obviously starting right off the bat, having quite a planned project. You know, you probably could say better what you thought of the whole experience, but from the supervisor side, it was very rewarding because it's always nice to have someone come in and have them almost be like a little baby, and then they learn to walk and then run.
And you see the progression.
Yeah.
Spread my wings.
Spread your wings. Fly.
Yeah, I could really see how you guys had kind of designed the project to, I guess, build my skills and slowly kind of introduce me to the project and what it was like being in a lab. Like, we started with the cell culture, the tissue culture, and learning all those skills before going into the assays and everything involving the imaging. And I think that was like a nice steady introduction. Yeah, you guys were really great at kind of nurturing my confidence through the process.
I'm glad you say that. And I think that's something that, you know, even I'm an early career researcher, but I've been doing wet lab for the last 10 years, right? And I think the thing is, this is something that we always learn because, like I say, we're working in Parkinson's disease research, and we take like a very specific title, and you think you're going to come in and you're going to immediately start like, you know, curing Parkinson's, obviously.
Yeah.
But actually the steps to curing Parkinson's are maybe a little bit boring at the start. You have to learn the skills first before you get to do the cool experiment. So we had to, you know, build it up. And I think that's something that any early career scientist should get to know, and with experience, understand the importance of like having it be a bit of a building block sort of thing, because that's how you get to answer those big questions.
Yeah.
If you run at it at full speed without any preparation, it's, I mean, you're going to struggle to make progress.
It, you can get kind of out outside of a level of like discomfort where it's, there's so many things. And you guys did a really great job of kind of introducing things at a pace where it was manageable and I could really see my skills building and really take it at a pace that I guess was feasible for an undergraduate being in this environment for the first time. I guess we could come back to some more specifics about the internship in a sec. Did you want to talk anything about your research and like what you're looking at the moment, what your plans are for the future?
My PhD was actually on the gut-brain axis. I was very interested in how amino acids that we get from the gut bacteria affects physiological processing in the body. But I think, you know, a lot of people probably say this about your, about the PhD. You end up going, spending so long on one topic, you just kind of want to leave it afterwards. My background in South Africa, where I did my undergrad and master's, was in HIV-associated dementia. So I had actually started in dementia research 8 years ago. And so I actually loved dementia research. And after I did the PhD, the gut-brain axis, which was very interesting, but I think I was still very passionate about dementia, so I came back to it. And now I'm working on Parkinson's disease, and I specifically liked the lab because they were working on very advanced cell culture models. So we are very lucky that we work very physically close to a lab that makes iPSCs, so induced pluripotent stem cells. And you can take these cells that have been reprogrammed into stem cells and make them into any cell you're interested in. And our lab does that. So they mostly make dopaminergic neurons, which are the brain cells in Parkinson's that are affected in this disease. And so I came to this lab because I specifically thought they were very good at the skill set, which they are. And so I was very lucky to learn how to do all of that. And so my first project with Richard was a GSK-funded project, so a pharmaceutical-funded project, and we were looking at a specific mutation in Parkinson's called GBA, and GBA is one of the major familial mutations in Parkinson's. So if about 10% of people will have a Parkinson's disease that they inherit, a much greater number have it for what we call sporadic reasons, so non-genetic, major genetic driving reasons. And so I was interested in this genetic type of Parkinson's. Spent about a year and a half looking at compounds that was hoping to change the disease phenotype in these dopamine neurons. Didn't find any, you know, hits, so like any compounds that were like really helping things. But GSK had a different project that they were funding in our lab that was looking at sporadic Parkinson's disease. And as I said, sporadic Parkinson's disease is a type of Parkinson's where, 90% of people have this. It doesn't have a major genetic driver. It could be anything from the environment or perhaps many small genetic changes that accumulate and drive the pathology of the disease. And so that's why I picked my current project. It works very closely with Michelle Hugh, Professor Michelle Hugh, who is a neurologist here in Oxford. So she and my supervisor, Richard, they both head up the Oxford Parkinson's Disease Center, the OPDC. And they recruited, I want to say like 1,000-something patients over 10 years, but for a very long time. Yeah. So it's a very good longitudinal study. And what I'm interested in is a subset of those 1,000 patients where we've taken 100 patients and we're looking at their skin cells. And Michelle has actually looked at all of these patients, and she thinks that there's a clinical subtyping that's happening in the patients based on symptoms. So she's actually classified them into 4 different types based on their symptoms. And I'm using their cells to try and figure out if there's a biological driver for what she's seeing in the clinic.
Wow, That's a great insight into, and you broke it down really well, so thank you. I guess I was wondering a little bit about how the funding works. So you're funded by a pharmaceutical company, is that right? How does that work?
Yeah.
Are there multiple channels that you can go down?
That's a multi-million dollar question. So doing a postdoc in academia, I didn't really even know this when I was doing my PhD. I think a lot of people assume that you have to ideally you want to get your own funding, you want to get a fellowship.
Yeah.
That means applying to a charitable organization or an institute itself, like a university itself, and they say, here's a bunch of money, go and do research, we think you're amazing, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But what happens more often than not is that a more established academic will get a pot of money, and then they will then use that pot of money to hire junior researchers who need to get their good wet lab experience until they get to the stage where they get to get their pot of money. But so you have to apply to postdoctoral positions that are advertised from more senior researchers. And how these senior researchers get their money, they could apply to charitable organizations. So for example, in our lab, we have Parkinson's UK, which funds us. We have Alzheimer's Research UK, AR UK, which funds us. But other than charitable organizations, we also have industry funding. So we work closely with GSK. There's a few other industry collaborations we have. And what the benefit of that is, and why it's different from just doing being an industrial scientist at GSK itself, is it's like kind of a beautiful marriage between two worlds that seem very different. I think there's a lot of great things about academia, and it's why I've chosen to stay. There's the kind of passion and knowledge you get from people who have been in doing research for over 20 years. Like, you can't buy that, you can't procure it in any sort of way. Like, these are just people that spend a lot of their time thinking about the science and educating about the science, and I think that's a big difference. You know, these are like, you're learning from people who have learned how to teach and who want to do that. And so the kind of knowledge you're surrounded by is, you know, you cannot purchase that, right? But what is great about industry is that they're very results oriented, and I think that's where you know, academics, we can be a little bit, you know, pie in the sky kind of thing. You know, you kind of like, there's a lot of passion, but we might take a little bit of time to get there. And industry is great at ensuring that things are being done as efficiently as they can be done. And it's a balance of those two things. I think what's really great about working on this project that's funded by GSK is that GSK have funded a whole institute being set up called the IMCM, which is what I'm part of. And they have three arms tackling neurodegeneration. So it's Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and ALS. And so what you also have in that is that you have a breadth of knowledge that you have access to. So researchers who are working on different things but maybe approaching it using similar techniques.
Yeah.
They also have a lot of like setup of data scientists that we have access to.
It really opens things up for collaboration, taking different people's skill set.
And
that's a really interesting way of setting things up, where you kind of can get the best of each mode of working.
You can also figure out, you know, part of being an early career researcher as well is to figure out whether you want to do this for the long haul, right?
Yeah.
And so you get a good idea of what it's like to be in an industry without actually making the jump yet.
That's true, yeah. Because I guess if you have such different goals in terms of your output and where you're looking in terms of research, it's probably good to get an idea of what fits best for you, how you prefer to work, what kind of people you'd like to collaborate with.
I definitely think that there's a lot of obvious advantages. I mean, the money is good, right? Like, the pharmaceutical companies are able to give us quite a lot of money, and that's really important when you're doing research, but also the way they operate is you have to deliver and you have to present a lot.
Yeah.
So we have monthly meetings where we present to our funders, and anyone in research usually has to do this, even if you're, you know, whoever your funders are. And that's a skill set that is you can only get by doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really an important skill set to try and hone. And I think that working with a pharmaceutical company, you kind of then learn how to speak their language.
Yes.
My first year was just kind of looking between my professor and the funders and just being like, how does he understand what they're saying? Because they use a lot of obviously technical jargon. They're always like, you know, for this quarter, they're always talking about quarters. We don't really talk about quarters. We talk about terms or, academia and just small little things. But it's important to almost speak the language so you're able to communicate better and go a bit further with the collaboration.
And I guess progressing in your own career, that collaboration might get close because maybe you're reaching out for funding and then you've got to speak their language.
Yes.
Look at how they would like to collaborate and work with researchers.
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted to ask about, I guess, any further research. What are you looking forward to looking at in more detail in the future? How's your project going to progress?
So like I said, the project involves looking at 100 people with sporadic Parkinson's disease. Michelle has clinically subtyped them in the clinic. She's symptomatically subtyped them. And I'm interested in whether what she's seeing in the symptoms, and symptoms, for example, of Parkinson's disease would be their tremor progression. So is their tremor getting worse quickly? Is it slower? Is it unilateral? Or is it happening on both sides of the body? It could be cognitive decline that the patient... So all of these different... There's so many different tests that they do in Parkinson's, and they've managed to use these 1,000 patients to get an understanding of 4 different subtypes. And I'm trying to figure out what is the biological driver, right? And the way I'm doing it is there's 2 organelles. So organelles are just like these little things in the cells that... do a function, right? And more or less, like, everyone would have heard, like, the mitochondria is the powerhouse.
Yes.
So more or less, like, I'm interested in the mitochondria, right? Because we think that the mitochondria is involved in Parkinson's. We have these specific neurons dying, and we think they die. One of the theories is that they die because they're so energy demanding. So they need so much to run that once they're not getting the amount of energy they need, they're the most vulnerable, so they die.
Yeah.
And so we think the mitochondria is involved. And then we know that with Parkinson's, there's this accumulation of these protein aggregates, so sticky proteins that just clump together, and they're physical, right? And they get in the way of processes in the brain. And so we think, why does a healthy brain not have that? A healthy brain doesn't have that because we have a really good disposal system in our body, and that's mostly maintained by our lysosomes, right? And so the recycling center is the lysosomes, and then the mitochondria is the energy center. And my project is trying to figure out, okay, so these 4 subtypes, does maybe someone who has very fast disease progression, do they have maybe both a mitochondrial and a lysosomal one? Does someone who has very slow disease progression, could it just be the lysosome that's being affected and not the mitochondria? And this is really important. I mean, everyone thinks that research is important. All research is important. But this
You're
is
not
specifically,
biased at all.
Yeah, this is specifically important because what we think we're doing is we're trying to, it's like kind of making it a bit more personal therapy, right?
Yes.
Because you're targeting the disease a bit more. A lot of times, if let's say we took this 1,000 patients, and let's say only 25% of them had a mitochondrial deficit, right?
Yeah.
But 25% of them do have a mitochondrial deficit.
Mm-hmm.
We give them a drug, and it's targeting the lysosome, and they don't see any changes, right? Because they're because of, we give them a drug and it's targeting the mitochondria, yeah. And we say, oh, only 25% it's helping. It's not making a difference. But actually, it is helping a big chunk of people. And maybe we need to be thinking about it in that way. Like, if that chunk of people have, like, a slow disease progression. So when we see that in the clinic, when someone is progressing slowly, maybe that's telling us something about the biology.
Okay, yeah. So looking for patterns in symptomatic patterns,
help with that kind of therapeutic intervention.
Wow, okay.
And yeah, so I'm hoping something will come off this in the next end of the year and hopefully build on this short term. I would like to stay with this project. I think there's a lot of different avenues. I think I'm very lucky that it's biology that I really trust and enjoy, but also there's a lot of new things that I get to experience as well. But long term, I was talking a lot about familial Parkinson's disease at the start. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got a lot of research in the West. So a lot of the patient cohorts we look at are predominantly white, predominantly European background. And I think all of the world, we're looking at more diverse cohorts, just because I'm from South Africa, and you know, in the African continent and in developing world in general, in Asia, in different developing countries, dementia is becoming a bigger and bigger problem. So we're going to need to have research that's looking at specific, you know, genetic differences in the cohorts. So long term, I would like to be involved in something. You know, specifically looking at African cohorts, trying to understand what are the familial drivers of the dementias we're seeing in that perspective.
Wow, that's so great that you found a field where you can see so many avenues and a long-term interest. So it sounds like diversity in science is something that you're really passionate about and want to make that a major part of your career. And having cohorts represented in the science and the data that we're collecting that is more representative of the world, the global world we live in. I'm assuming you're interested in that being reflected in the scientists are doing the research as well.
1,000%. And that's why, you know, Brent and I both were so interested in the Uni Plus program. You know, specifically, like, the program's amazing in the sense that it's well funded, I believe. And I think that's the biggest thing about internships, right? Because there's a lot of people who come, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. People who want to learn should have a space to learn. But it's very unfortunate that a lot of times students can't just go and do a 6-week internship.
Unpaid. It's not feasible.
And there's a lot of brilliant students like yourself who I'm not able to do that, right? And I believe firmly that having different voices, including different voices and different faces in anything, not just science, in any form of life, is going to make whatever better, right? Like whatever we're cooking up here in the lab, like it's going to make the sauce better. And so you know, the thing is, like, what we all have in common is, like, the passion. And so I really was interested in, because it's a lot of time. It's a lot of, you're dedicating your time, but I wanted to dedicate my time to something and someone that I thought could benefit from this a lot, right? And it's something that I'm very passionate about, especially I've been in Oxford for 9 years now. I came here as a grad student, now I'm working here, and I think Oxford is a very beautiful city. It's a very, it's an amazing university to work for. And, you know, it's becoming more diverse, which is important, but that's definitely a problem it's had in its past, right? And it's very unusual because now I find myself to be in a little bit of a position of privilege. Not something that I ever thought I would be in. Privilege in the sense of, like, I get paid to do science, which is still crazy for me, right? Cool. It's you know, 10-year-old Kalina would be like, what on earth? That's what we do. We get paid to do research. That's amazing. And I think it's very important to, you know, ensure the things that were hard for you are easier for the next people.
Yeah.
And
breaking down those barriers.
Breaking down those barriers. And, like, you know, I think... no one's against this. Like, maybe I'm very optimistic, right? But I don't think anyone thinks diversity and inclusivity is a bad thing.
Mm.
I think it's just about ensuring that we have those platforms in place.
Yeah, things like this program,
which I think was very, you know, for example, like I'll give you an example, right? Like, this has changed now, I think. But 5 years ago, the university, you had to pay, I think it was £50, for your application fee, right?
Yes.
And I come from South Africa. I had a flatmate. She comes from Trinidad in the Caribbean. We're both not from rich families. Anyway, like, the university was very proud of this one scholarship that you get. Anyone who can apply to Oxford gets automatically put into the scholarship, right? Get automatically considered for the scholarship.
Yeah.
But then they were like, it's open to anyone. And I was on one of the student feedback things. I was like, well, it's open to anyone who can afford £50. And the thing is, like, from a British sense, it's, you know, very, it's like anyone can afford £50, right?
But convert it to the rand.
You know, my old flatmate, she said, well, you know, her mom didn't have a credit card. She had no way of paying that application fee.
Yeah.
And so they had to get, like, a neighbor to pay it, and then you know, you don't, from our lovely Oxford, we don't really think about all of these things, right?
We don't see, I guess, through the privilege.
Exactly. And you never, and it's no one's fault, right? Like, if people sitting in the meeting rooms, you can't expect them to understand that if they've never lived that and never experienced that. It's not their fault. It's important for people then who have had those experiences to give that feedback and say, hey, you know.
Yeah, and that's why we need them in the room.
We need them in the room. And that's why I think it's good that, you know, the universities are taking feedback. I think they've stopped the application fee, or they've got I don't think they've stopped it completely, which I guess is fair because it gets a lot of applications coming in, but they've got a merit waiver. So if you are, you know, the caliber to go to the university, you shouldn't have to pay, you know, £50, which again seems not a lot, but to someone, you know, some people in South Africa, £50 is what they use to feed their whole family for maybe 2 weeks, you know, and put that into perspective.
But I think they, so for people who've done the program that I've done, they've got a waiver. We can be exempt from the application fee.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so there's different ways that they're trying to make it possible, because imagine you're not just applying for one program, applying across the board, because you've got to spread it out. You can't apply just to one and hope.
I have friends who've had to, like, apply all over the UK, in the US, and they said they spend thousands on application fees, because the US is another, you know, a whole other ballgame, right? And this is insane. And that's why I was super keen on, you know, investing my time in a program like this. I'd be curious to know as well. Well, obviously, I was very interested in, as I said, skin cells in Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
I was interested in the mitochondria and the lysosome. And, specifically, one of our little baby projects ended up being, how do these these energy centers in the cells get recycled? So it's a process called mitophagy, which Brent and I found interesting. But how did you pick the project? Like, what attracted you to the program, and specifically our little project?
So I guess there are a lot of ways to answer that question. I think applying for the research internship in general, it's quite hard to get experience in a wet lab setting as an undergraduate, other than the labs we do as part of our modules. It's just quite hard to access kind of real experience other than our third year project where we're in the deep end straight away. And I wanted to consider whether maybe research was something I wanted to do in my future, and I just wanted to trial it out and see how it went.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we want from students. We actually, yeah. I think a lot of students, when they're applying for internships, they think that people like have this idea that we're going to take like these baby scientists and make them like win Nobel Prizes. I mean, it would be phenomenal if that happened. It's not what we expect, right? What we've all been baby scientists, and what we want is to give someone an opportunity to figure out, is this for me? Yeah. Because a lot of times, like, people will go straight into a PhD. I went straight into a PhD without doing an internship, right?
Yeah.
I just got super lucky that I ended up liking it. But, like, if you never did a little short project to figure out, is this what I want my day-to-day life to look like?
Yeah.
You might end up having a really terrible time of your PhD.
Yeah.
And that's a big investment that you've put in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we actually, like, a lot of, if you see internships being put out, don't expect that the people who are putting them out expect you to be like, you know, curing whatever disease. Like, we expect you to be getting like skills from this that's not even going to benefit us, is going to benefit you.
And I guess it's even valuable information in terms of, if it shows you some things that you might not want to do, it points you in a direction of something you never even imagined.
Yeah.
I think going into my degree, I didn't think wet lab work would be something that I'd be very good at.
And you ended up being great.
Thanks. I found labs quite challenging. There was a lot to process. Uh-huh. It was hard to keep up. It felt like everyone knew what they were doing and I didn't. So to go into a space where I had longer to figure things out, I guess I had one-on-one mentorship. Mm-hmm. That was amazing. That I didn't get that in labs during modules, because it's just not feasible. So that was a really valuable part, and I think that was kind of what I was looking for. I wanted confirmation of whether I could see myself in that kind of environment.
And it benefits us, like, obviously, to have students figure that out early on, right?
Yeah.
And because we don't want to be taking students in for PhDs who don't want to be doing it.
Yeah.
So it's good for students to have figured that out and know that they want to do that going forward. And also, it's, you know, the project we planned was something that I didn't have any time to do. Brent didn't have any time to do. We thought was very interesting. We thought was feasible in the time scale. And so it was win-win-win for everyone, right?
Yeah. So I guess we could segue onto what the project actually was and what it involved, and maybe the day-to-day kind of, I guess, what we were up to in the lab every day. So primarily we were looking at assessing autophagy and mitophagy.
You can't see this right now, but Francesca looks like I'm examining
her. Wow, nowhere to call me out. It's like describing the project to the person who designed the project back at them.
You're doing well.
Thank you. We were looking at, we used a genetic reporter. Uh-huh. I guess overall we were looking at autophagy and mitophagy flux. So I guess I'll explain a little bit about what that is. Autophagy would be the degradation of protein aggregates, dysfunctional organs. Anything not quite working in your cell. And then mitophagy is specific to the mitochondria, removing any dysfunctional mitochondria. Yeah. And it's kind of been shown that that process is defective, would you say, in Parkinson's, and it may be involved in this aggregation of alpha-synuclein, which is characteristic of Parkinson's.
Very good.
Thank you. So we used a fluorescence reporter to have a look at the flux, the change in patient lines, so those with a GBA mutation compared to healthy controls, and just to see how the these two processes differed. And to do this with this fluorescence reporter, is it called Opera Phoenix?
The Opera Phoenix.
Yeah.
Like MVP of the lab. Like, yeah.
It's a very high throughput confocal microscope that we could image these cells under, I guess, different treatments to have a look at, how these processes were changing in the different conditions.
And you got to do that.
You got to
learn how to use that.
Yeah. So I guess it started with, because we were using these patient-derived skin cells, it started with culturing those. So I learned a lot about working in a tissue culture hood and making sure everything was kept clean, because everything has to be sterile because you don't want any contamination.
Have you forgotten how to do that in real life now? As in, because you know you get really neurotic about
Absolutely not, because in my lab now we're working with proteins and it's very different, and I don't work in a fume and a tissue culture hood anymore at all, and it's so unusual for me to not be working in a hood, not use ethanol. Anyway, so from there we did a lot of imaging under these different conditions, then the data analysis process where I used some software that made
a pipeline.
Yeah. And then I guess I had to collate this all into a presentation and give this presentation at a conference for all the internships. Yeah. And so that was kind of like wrapped the project up at the end.
6 weeks, right?
Yeah. It was
crazy
quick.
They did all of that in 6 weeks.
And I guess I think it was an amazing experience because it very closely mimics what my final year project has been like so far.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Because the
so
time...
it really set you up for that. That's
it
good.
Really did.
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, it kind of... I could hit the ground running with it almost, because a lot of things were familiar. Not just the pipetting in the lab, but how the lab works, how lab meetings work, how they work together. I guess how to research things, how to ask questions. I think one thing that was like so valuable was learning to ask the stupid questions, because I just learned here how valuable it was in understanding.
And there's no stupid questions.
And I'm learning that slowly. It's hard. You've got to like get it into your brain, because the more questions I ask,
the less mistakes you'll make down the line.
Exactly.
And it benefits everyone. To ask stupid questions.
And it makes you less stupid, because you understand the nuance of things. Because I think if you have misunderstood one small aspect of something and you let that sit there, then you misunderstand a larger concept going on. But if you address that small thing that you haven't quite understood, it's probably quite simple. It helps you understand the project as a whole.
Completely. And like we're doing neuroscience research, right? We understand brains work differently.
Yes.
If I say something to you and you don't tell me you don't get it, I'm going to assume you've got it, right?
Yeah.
And if you tell me I don't get it, I'm not going to say it back the exact same way. No. I'm going to go, oh, so this person's brain works slightly different, which is normal. Different is not bad. It just means, let me try and explain this in a different way.
Exactly.
And so, again, no stupid questions. It might just be that you're getting information inputted to you in a different format. You need to file change that somehow.
And maybe you've just skipped a step and it's helped go back.
And I'll be really curious, because it was just 6 weeks, it went so fast. We spent a ton of time in the lab. But I know there was like, you know, obviously you're coming to a different city, you're getting set up here for 6 weeks. So what do you think was the biggest like life lesson you got outside of the lab with this internship?
That's a big question. I think you had so many things. Meeting the other internships, because it was a relatively big cohort and we also lived together in, I guess, student accommodation. And meeting people who were doing similar degrees and maybe came from like a very diverse range of backgrounds. It was like an amazing networking thing, but also amazing to see people that maybe came from a background similar to mine, having the same ambitions as me. And that was really amazing. So yeah, I think just socially it was incredible to have so many people in that space have kind of similar aspirations to you, and to keep in touch with them now and have that group of people.
I think it's really important to like find your tribe wherever you are, and to have like, it's obviously important to have like many different backgrounds around you, but also to have someone who kind of understands where you're coming from.
I guess it's like the whole thing of, do you see yourself in this role, do you see people like you doing the things you want to do? And I got to meet people that are wanting to do the things I want to do, that I shared experiences with. So that was that was pretty great. So I guess we can wrap up with just a brief question for you. Is there anything that you would have liked to have known as an undergraduate, or any advice you might have been given, maybe particularly about finding out what you were interested in, figuring out how to get more experience? What you would like.
Well, that's a great question. I think what I've learned is that, you know, all your life, like all my life at least, and I'm sure a lot of people have this, when you're growing up, you're told to study and you're told how important it is to do well in school, and you kind of get that, you know, you understand and obviously that's important. But I think not enough people told me how important it was to be like a three-dimensional human being. Like, and how important it is to, you know, really have hobbies and do things that are not just your degree or science.
Yeah.
You know, I worked a lot with a woman empowerment charity in my undergrad and in my honors degree in South Africa, and I had this really cool opportunity where I was hired as an events coordinator, so I was getting paid to help put on like events for these female professors. But it's what was amazing about Prof Thiru's organization was that she let me sit in on their like meetings, their board meetings.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was like this 20-year-old kid that was getting to listen to a bunch of female professors discuss what were the best ways to tackle different kind of issues they had in academia.
Yeah.
And I got to like more or less be in the room where it was happening, right? The thing is, like, if I just stuck to my books, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. And if I didn't do that, then I wouldn't have had that glowing recommendation from Prof Thiru, which eventually led me to getting the scholarship to Oxford and stuff, right? But what it did set me up with is like all of these soft skills, right?
Yeah.
So because I started talking to academics and understanding how to talk the language, and then you know, you so much of what you do is interviews and being interpersonal skills that you can only develop by doing, right?
Yeah.
And so just getting a lot of that exposure. When I was doing my undergrad here at Oxford, I was doing like science communication for like a student science organization.
Yeah.
And I was writing about science and communicating about science, and that really helped when I was being interviewed for the job that I have now.
Yeah.
And so so obviously work hard, it's really important, but you never know the kind of hobbies you do, the kind of passion projects you follow, how that's going to really feed into you as a human being that then goes on to be a scientist or whatever it is. Like, I don't know if that's a good answer. But
no, I love that answer. I think because it not only pays off in terms of your own personal growth, you also are then developing all the skills you need to progress in your career, and probably also finding out more about what you like and what you don't, and making more informed decisions in terms of the direction you go in. Yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess we wrap up here. Thank you so much for chatting to me today.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been great to catch up.
Yeah, it's been lovely to chat and